shut down. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you, Daryl. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
All right, welcome to the Active Directory Systems Overview Protocol Documents session. Let me just give you a couple of cues as to what we're going to be doing in this session, but first I'll start with some introductions. My name is Dean Wells. I'm a senior program manager in the Active Directory product group. Been with the company for about a year and a half and have used Active Directory since before it was called that. On the front row, we've got three additional Active Directory product group members. We have Nathan Mugney. He's our lead program manager. We have Matt Reimer. He's a long-term Active Directory developer. He's not as old as he should be, but he's been with the product group for a long, long time. Probably one of the most knowledgeable Active Directory people on the planet, so if you have any questions, just go to him. Just don't worry about us. Sorry, Matt, I figured I'd at least make your life hard. Next to him, we have another lead senior development guy, Sunil Parthasarathi. How'd I do?
Yes.
Okay, I've been practicing his last name all night, and I think I just got that right, so good for me. So there's a total of four of us from the AD product group, and then we have Mishiko here. She represents Kerberos. You may have seen her already. I'm not sure if you've presented or if you are presenting. But either way, if you have any security-related questions that piggyback on top of Kerberos or KDCs, then she's your gal. And we have some more as well. I don't know them by name, but I do know by face.
David Pickett,
again, from Mishiko's team. Sasha? Okay. Wonderful. So you have a grand total of seven of us in attendance. All right, let me give you a quick idea then in terms of session objectives. Obviously, we have two overview documents within the Active Directory Protocol Family Suite. We've got the Active Directory System Overview, and we've got the Domain Interactions System Overview. Our goal here is to basically give you an idea of what those documents focus upon, highlight any differences in the applicability of each for those of you that are new to this, and provide a forum for Q&A, which I think is one of our primary goals here, because obviously we do our best to address what you want to know, but only you know the questions you want to ask. So obviously, this is going to be a great forum for that. So there are the two docs listed in the usual form. So let's just jump straight in and take a look at some of these specifics. So ADSO uses the protocol family system document template. For those of you that are familiar with this, it has a very rigid sort of layout. The sections always arrive in exactly the same place, so it gives you a very good idea of where you should begin. It highlights the purpose of AD as a directory service, nothing radical there. Describes the relationships of the protocols that comprise our client-server behavior, obviously for accessing directory data, the traditional CRUD operations, create, read, update, delete, for those of you that aren't familiar with that commonplace acronym inside Microsoft. Obviously describes intended client-server functionality, illustrates how the various protocols interact, etc. So a very, very useful bootstrapping point for you to get your hands on AD and know which documents you should go to thereafter. Versioning is present in there, and obviously how the versioning of the system affects the behavior. And obviously, there's some very, very specific details in the documents that ADSO points to. This is meant to be a holistic picture of the whole system end-to-end. So in this particular doc, we also present a number of use case interactions with the Active Directory system, and obviously, we identify stakeholders. That's part of the template. DSO specifics, again, Domain Interactions Systems Overview. So for those of you that aren't as AD familiar as perhaps you would like to be, let me just see if I can define the difference in the split here. Active Directory, in terms of the ADSO doc, defines what we like to coin, and this is one of Matt's particular phrases here, the directoriness of the directory. So it's the X500-like behaviors. That is mostly encompassed by ADSO. The domain-like behaviors, which provide the Windows-like join, domain join concepts and management capabilities, that's covered by DSO. I don't think there is a good abstract high-level definition that is 100% accurate across the board, but that's the best one we've come up with to date to split and define where the two actually divide the technology. This one uses a different template. This is the defined task system template, so there are many, many actions defined in this, a slew of them, that will talk you through how a particular client interacts with the domain and how the state gets updated as that interaction proceeds. Describes many, many protocols, so here's a couple of examples. This may actually be exhaustive, I'm not positive though. Locating a domain controller using DNS and NetBIOS. Joining a domain, obviously using a predefined account. There's one here by using the Security Account Manager or SAMRPC. And joining a domain using LDAP. The three of these combined give you the elements that allow you to basically use any approach or any hybrid thereof. So there's a reason for them being broken down in that way. And obviously how you disjoin or remove a domain member from the domain, that's also covered. So moving into ADSO in terms of content, let's take a quick snippet at the table of contents itself and give you some idea of what we discuss in each of those sections. So you can see here in section two, obviously we cover the system modes. We have Active Directory DS and Active Directory LDS. Common terminology represents these as Active Directory flavors. You may have heard that as a stereotypical term. So we have the directory service in its domain service mode, DS. which is whereby we integrate that domain controller on top of the Windows platform and provide domain management services. This is the platform upon which things such as group policy and DFS are built and provide the overall centralized management that we've come to know and love over the past decade or so. And then LDS is that directory nature, that directory behavior, sucked out of the DS build, and it just presents itself as a much more X500-like directory service, absent of the Windows management semantics. I.e., there's no notion of policy in LDS in the same way as there is inside DS. It's just about the X500 or the directory services-like behaviors. System purposes are a common section to most of these SO documents. Foundation and background knowledge is covered there. We'll discuss that one in a second. And then here we have a number, as I mentioned earlier, of system use cases, which is a very, very useful way to accelerate your learning. Just by going through the use cases, you can see precisely how certain functionality is implemented, and again, how the state changes according to that process. The system environment itself is covered in the system context, and we'll talk about that one in a little bit more detail in a second. So here's an example of some of the system versioning. Again, I don't particularly like the term versioning, but we don't have much of a choice here. It's more along the lines of flavors or incremental features being added on as the product progresses. Some do have a direct correlation to version, some do not. For example, in my mind, I don't think of LDS and DS as versions. I think of them as flavors of Active Directory at its core. But nonetheless, they're called out here in that particular way. So if you take a look, there's a particular mode, another synonym for that, ADDS without web services, which particular protocols are supported by that version, to use the correct terminology here. And then obviously we provide the schema definitions over on the right with the necessary links. The ADA document suites, anything prefixed with ADA is talking about the schema. ADSC is the classes, the ADAs are the attributes. And then there's one other, which is LS, I believe I'm getting that right, which is the LDS schema componentry. So this contains all of the definitions for you regarding what each attribute does at a bare bones level and what its purpose in life is, where a definition is actually feasible. ADDS with web services, obviously web services is a component we added in R2, and we've made that compatible now as far back as 2003 SP2, I think, and 2K8. So obviously there's a level of applicability here across those builds of Windows as well. And then ADLDS without web services, just LDAP. Again, that's a good differentiator you can see here because these two would be roughly comparable otherwise, but as soon as you take off the web services componentry, the only thing you're left with is LDAP, since that's the X500-like implementation of our service. Background knowledge and system concepts. A fundamental section to understanding the rest of any of these SO documents. If you can actually maintain your level of concentration and read this end-to-end, skipping over those which you already know implicitly, you'll probably find value in doing so, but not an easy task to undertake. Obviously, it defines our usage of the terms within the context of this document, which is valuable for any reader.
I have a question about that slide 4. Why yeah. There was some attribute that we saw yesterday in some test suites that will not be available on the LDAP.
In many cases, we have it specifically called out in the ADA docs as to which particular version of the product this attribute is applicable to. But okay, so the question is basically asking which particular attributes or how you highlight which attributes are only applicable to DS versus LDS, if I understood it correctly. Yes? So in your specific example scenario, you're talking about trust relationships, which obviously have no applicability to LDS, but how would you know that from looking at the certain docs? It's a good question. I'd have to scavenge through each of the ADAs and the LS documentation to take a look at the definitions on a per attribute or attribute by attribute basis to figure it out. But with inside LS itself, I believe that only lists the set of attributes that are specific to the LDS implementation. So by process of elimination, what's not in there compared to the others, they're not appropriate for LDS. That would be my approach to it. I don't know if you guys have anything more valuable to add.
Specifically on trust objects. Trust objects are detailed, documenting detail in... Since we're talking about trust objects, trust objects are documented in detail in MSADTS, the TDO, Trusted Domain Object section. So, in that document, we always talk about, what is supported on ADDS, what is supported by ADLDS, and which is supported by both. So, in that section, I mean, in general, if you're looking at something like trust, you would start with, you want to understand the trust objects in Active Directory, you would look at MSADTS. That's going to tell you all the details about them, where they're found, what the meaning of each attribute is, how it's processed.
Yeah, I think it depends on the direction of the question that you're asking or the context you find yourself in.
I'm trying to understand where it comes from. Like, is it like, I was imagining like the Active Directory builds up like a directory tree, like the registry. how come some of the attributes does not show up in the light directory,
Well, mainly because not everything is needed for the light directory. The Active Directory, ADLDS is a very stripped down directory service. It's, it starts with a minimal schema with the intent that, applications will extend the LDS schema as needed. There are no trusts in ADLDS, so you're not going to, for example, find any trust attributes because they serve no purpose there.
So it's not on the schema, so you can't get it, although it's in the actual raw data?
No, there are no trusts in ADLDS.
So there's no notion of trust relationship between two discrete LDS instances as there is with Active Directory domain services.
As Dean was saying before, there's this notion of the S500 style information, which is part of ADSO and is sort of the domain related information. Trusts are fundamental to sort of the domain concept. So they're part of ADDS. They're not part of the pure S500 model, which is basically what ADLDS is built on.
That's your point.
Sure.
Good question. Thanks. Let me jump off of that one again. Okay, yeah, so as I was saying, let me just reiterate there. This is one of those sections that's common to all SO documents, so pretty much any other SO that's based upon the same at least protocol family template is going to have these same sections. So section 3 is always a good place to jump into and make sure your terminology is on par with the way we define it. Obviously, some of these terms are very commonplace in the industry, and there may be a little bit of diluting as the definitions go between implementations. The system protocols themselves, well, this is an entire list of them end-to-end. So obviously these protocols, as I mentioned earlier, implement the CRUD operations. Again, create, rename, update, delete. And there's an important note here. If you take a look at that, I really do loathe it when a presenter just reads out an entire bullet, but I really couldn't say that any more concisely since I wrote it. So if you'd like to take a read of that note, it's very valuable. So essentially, for the sake of the recording, we're saying that I'm going to have to read it, aren't I? A given protocol may also expose only some of the directory objects in the directory tree, and for those objects exposed by the protocol, only some of the attributes may be exposed, e.g. SAMR. So what we're basically saying is that we've got a suite of attributes that apply to a given object or an element if we're being more abstract, and depending on the protocol head with which you interface that element or interface to that element, you may actually only have a subset of the attributes available to you. Okay, which is, again, yes, similar to yours. Not quite the same, but on a similar path. Here's ADSO's view of the protocols required to build an AD system. So for example, if you want to know how do I go ahead and build a compatible Active Directory implementation, ADSO, from the directory services standpoint at least, ADSO is a great start point because it gives you a precise idea of which documents you need to go and read more thoroughly, i.e. end-to-end, consume the specifics of those behaviors, and then go ahead and obviously implement your own. So this is somewhat of a table of contents mechanism for you if you want to know how to implement a certain behavior of the Active Directory system. And there are obviously a number of relevant standards with which we either comply or comply and extend. In this particular case, we are LDAP v2 compliant. Are we LDAP v3 compliant or compatible? Do we state that or not? I think we'll go with v3.
Since no one's ever really officially defined an LDAP v3 compatibility test, there is no one test. There are some. I mean, it's hard to. There isn't a single LDAP
v3 certification. There's no single RFC. Yep.
Okay. So I mean, we are compatible with it. We document an MSADTS. Where we extend it, where we diverge in some places from the RFCs.
Okay, so that's well highlighted by the document MSADTS, where we make specific divergences from those standards that do exist by RFC definition. Nathan, did you have something you wanted to add to that? No.
Question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So the SAMR and LDAP. So SAMR, much of the functionalities can be done by LDAP. Does it mean that
depending on if you were talking about an LDS compatible system, then yes, you could implement just LDAP. SAMR is not required for LDS. If you wanted to implement an Active Directory domain system, then you're going to be compatible to the point that you're absent of that particular protocol head. So there are going to be APIs that leverage SAMR that are no longer going to function against your implementation due to the absence of it.
In order to be compatible with Active Directory, all the documented protocols need to be implemented because an Active Directory domain controller does support all those protocols, and so applications, both Windows APIs, third-party applications, are free to use any and all and a combination of those protocols. So any system which does not implement those protocols in full is going to have areas of incompatibility. It's not going to be compatible with the main controller.
So are you, can you tell me if you're implementing a server or a domain join client? Okay, so in that case, the question is do I use SAMR or do I use LDAP? So from a protocol documentation standpoint, where we document both fully, and any nuances between them would be covered in the protocol documentation. It kind of depends on the exact scenario.
So what we're looking at doing is trying to incorporate into the security system of the domain. We're not interested in implementing all the tree, like the group policies, the users. We just want to be a node on the tree that is trusted and can do authentication, delegations, SMB proxy, forwarding, be able to participate in session key exchanges.
So act like a domain member, essentially.
Yeah, but from that perspective only.
Basically, our product is doing a one acceleration. So it can take just like SIFs or SMB or exchange traffic. It can go encrypted. And we want, in order to do that, we want on the branch level, let's say the corporate is here, and you have an office in China, and you want to accelerate the traffic over the one, so you'll open the encryption in the branch in China. You can do your optimization, then encrypt it again before it goes on the one, and then open the encryption and both devices, like the cache devices, will talk about.
So there's a couple ways I look at that. One is, what protocol should I use to create some objects in the directory from a CRUD perspective? And you have SAMR, LDAP, and in fact, we've got web services as part of Windows 7, and then there's many different protocols that you can use to create objects in AD. Just from that perspective, you want to take a look at the protocol docs to see for what type of objects you're creating, if there's any differences. Personally, if we were to write MSDN documentation and suggest a protocol, I would do LDAP, but our protocol docs are complete. Let me just start by saying that.
But if you choose LDAP, you will be backward compatible with all the existing controllers.
Are you going to be backwards compatible with all the existing domain controllers? That one, I can't answer off the top of my head. You'd have to go read in the protocol docs for any version information.
Actually, I can answer that question.
Give the mic back.
If you're writing any and all existing domain controllers, no, because by definition, pre-Windows 2000 domain controllers do not support LDAP, since Active Directory does not exist before Windows 2000.
So Matt's specifically referring to NT4 and its predecessors, which didn't implement an LDAP protocol head in any way, shape, or form. We still term that a domain controller. Again, I would have to jump with Nate on this one. It's 10 years worth of history here, and for us to answer off the top of our head would be bold, to say the least. My guess is the answer is yes, but that is nothing more than a guess off the top of my head.
I also noticed like LDAP would be like a mainstream good option to catch the majority of things. And then on the corners, we might find out.
Yeah. Right? If you want to catch, you need to update. It's only the same.
Yeah. On the corner, we might end up, having that as well.
And it depends on the attribute. We just talked about the main time. Be able to do the authentication.
So the question is for authentication, is that going to be a problem? So for members, right, authentication is handled at the domain controller, right? We don't retrieve any data from a member server for authentication, right? We create an authenticator, and that gets passed to the domain controller. So I guess my question is, I don't understand, what do you think you need to retrieve from a domain controller in order to authenticate? What protocol are you using such that you would have to retrieve information before authenticating?
Before you authenticate, our device has to be part of the
network. No, right? Because we support Kerberos, and we support interoperability between our Kerberos and MIT's Kerberos, and MIT has no concept of a domain join, and those systems can authenticate just fine, as long as you pre-populated an object, right? So in the AD, there's an object and the secret that's been, provisioned. Authentication works.
You'd need some means of maintaining the shared secret between the domain and themselves.
Yeah, you have to maintain the shared secret, so like Kerberos.
Oh, no, I get this one, but he's talking about domain join.
No, actually, I'm talking
about... Wow, look at this. Product groups fighting to answer over your questions.
I have the answer. Well, you said Kerberos. So Kerberos has a protocol, the Kerberos password change protocol, which is supported. So if you use the Kerberos password change protocol, that would work.
So let's say I'm doing a server. I have a service key.
okay? So when the client sends the authentication, I'm not talking with the domain controller because I have a service key. I can authenticate the client except from the MS back. Like, but I can, if it doesn't have the MS back, you can authenticate, right? So my question is, like, how am I as a server can communicate with the domain controller? Because the KDC is the one that will give the IP, the ticket of the server. So you have to integrate to the domain in order to maintain the keys. So that's what we want to understand.
So one thing I want to clarify about domain join, and so I'm the architect owner for DSO, is a domain join machine is really a matching of two abstract data models, one on the client with a certain set of elements and one on the server with a certain set of elements. The relationship between those two ADMs define domain join. Now, how do you create those ADMs on the server, the list of attributes or elements needed, like the shared key, is actually something that you could choose either SAMR or LDAP. And DSO tries to go into an example where you could use SAMR or LDAP to actually create the server state or the domain controller state representing domain join. Domain join is no doesn't have a protocol per se. Domain join is a state, again, matched by a certain set of elements on the client, shared key, domain name, and some other ones. And then on the domain controller, a certain set as well. But there's no domain join protocol that keeps those elements, say, for example, in sync or anything else. And then creating the domain controller side elements for the domain join account could be done, again, via SAMR or LDAP. Even Windows implementations changed throughout the years. I think Windows 7, as in protocol documentation, we switched to LDAP to do some of our domain join operations.
Yeah.
One follow-up question. To be able to do NRPC, to the net log on, you need to be part of the domain.
So in MS Auth also, I was just reading this, the content last night, is it the net logon doc or the also that talks about you must be domain joined in order for secure MSN RPC? Authso has a task for interactive domain logon.
You have the service key, right? Let's say I configure the domain that the service key change, the password for the service change every 14 days. So my server have to participate in a scenario that's called during the test, like maintenance, that the domain controller would connect me and give me an update of the new service password every 14 days or something like that.
So I believe it's in MSAMR, but we talk about, or ADTS, I forget the exact reference right now, but computer accounts as an object class are not subject to password policies, and those passwords are not managed by the domain controller. So it's up to the implementer to manage the password.
The password?
Windows clients for computer accounts.
Computer accounts.
Yes. So Windows clients themselves, every 30 days, as in the protocol documentation, as a best practice.
About servers, let's say I'm doing a file server, or let's say it's an exchange server. So who's maintaining the password?
For the machine account, representing that.
Yeah. The client operating system hosts
the domain client, it manages the password. AD, or the domain controller, doesn't actually reach out to a server and say, you know, change your password. It doesn't work like that.
Policy that it automatically changes every 14 days.
Password policies do not apply to computer accounts.
So when you're seeing that password policy?
Okay, so in Windows, the domain controller doesn't do any kind of password management or password sync to clients, right? It maintains a database, it synchronizes it amongst its members, right? Now, password policies, all that does is say that you need to change your password before you can get authenticated, right? But the DC doesn't give you a password or anything like that, right? Domain controllers are just storage facilities for passwords. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So what it'll say to the protocol is you can't authenticate until you change your password. And then it's up to that application to do a password change, correct? And then that password change will occur, and at that point, the AD or the DS, maybe I'm getting that terminology wrong, updates that bit, and because the password's been changed, right?
That's
and
computers
so
and computer accounts.
That includes that's computer accounts, that's user accounts. Either of them can be used for services. It doesn't matter. Now, computer accounts are not a managed service account, which is a type of computer account. The managed service account. So it's new for Win 7.
Like any exchange?
So, well, exchange and those things tend to use either computer accounts or user accounts because the managed service accounts are new for Win 7. But only user accounts have, and that's what Nathan was saying, only user accounts have password policy enforcement on it. Computer accounts are managed by whoever owns that object, right? So Windows clients, right, the Windows operating system will periodically change that. But again, these are not being forced down from a central location. Okay. It's up to them to change the password and then provide that to the AD.
It's highly advisable to change the password.
Yes. Well, yeah, and we do. It's good hygiene, right? So Windows as an operating system does periodically change its password.
Like when we ask the exchange group, they say they don't know how we, the service accounts, like the keys accounts, whatever, it's done like every other service. If it's not the
they're probably running it as system, and so the computer takes care of that for them.
The OS, basically.
They can. If they choose to deploy as a user account, then somebody is going to have to manage that password, which is probably why they don't advise that route, because then you get the password management headache. Does that clarify everything?
Yeah,
so and like I said, how the password changes is independent of the application, right? So for computers, you know, whatever service basically changes that password will leverage his protocol, basically NetLog on.
Right.
So, you know, you can also use, like I said, for Kerberos, we always advise, since there is actually a change password protocol, just use the change password protocol of the standard. That way you can ensure that it works with us and any other Kerberos.
Did everybody catch that then? So the general conclusion there to that rather lengthy debate was that the client does this, not the DC. So the DC is, as Mashiko says, nothing more than a database in which the password is stored. From the client's standpoint, it's its responsibility to perform that good hygiene and keep things up to date, or at least as secure as they can be. Good question. Very good question. Okay, now there's an additional item here. Obviously, we were just talking about R2 and the fact that we've added managed service accounts, which is a component specific to the Win 7 client or Server 2008 R2 implementations, which also abide by the same basic logic that Mashiko and Nathan just outlined with regard to computer account password management. MSAs are a version of a user that aren't subject to that. They come with R2. Likewise, the web service comes with Server 2008 R2 and provides these additional member protocols for you guys to actually interact with. Obviously, each of the documents here, these were written specifically for the R2 implementation and provides a web services compatible-like interface to Active Directory, so it's completely abstract of LDAP, at least from your standpoint. ADSO, then, Section 5. Here's a breakdown of the table of contents. You can see each of the member protocols that we were just focusing on. Let's dive into some of that detail and have a quick look. So what about some of the member protocol roles and groups? Well, if we take a look at the top here, we've got four particular tables here. So what is it that provides general purpose directory tree access for AD? So if your objective is to do something that you consider to be a general purpose CRUD-like operation, then you have these options available to you. There is no implied order of precedence or choice there, but obviously, as you've heard us all mention, if we were going to make that choice, we tend to sway toward LDAP. Could be history, could be because it's better. Difficult to say at this point. Provides limited directory tree access. Obviously, SAMR, that's been around for an awful long time. We do still entirely support it. As Nathan mentioned, we entirely document it, and there are still many pieces of software out there, including our own, that still leverage this. This is an ADDS-specific protocol. It does not apply to ADLDS. Okay, I was wondering if I was going to get some questions on that one, but no. Okay, what about task-oriented directory tree access? Well, obviously, we've got some mentioned. Yes, sir, go ahead. Sure.
We ran into a problem where we had a cross-forest trust, a one-way cross-forest trust, where we trusted him but he doesn't trust us. We couldn't retrieve information about a user via LDAP. We had to call back to SAMR.
Which
way were you trying to retrieve the information there?
Trusts are such that this domain trusts that domain.
Here we go. So in your scenario,
verified of A, A trusts B.
Okay.
And we just got a SID that looks like it came from B. What name is associated with the SID?
trust and do an LDAP lookup and so on. And as far as we can tell, B said, I don't trust you. I'm not going to give you any information.
Yes, it did.
But Sam R would give us the information.
I think it relates to the question I asked in the slide that you showed. You answered me, I think you answered this question, but I meant that some of the attributes of the trust, some of the attributes, I don't understand why, are not existing when you're doing light directory lookup. Yeah. They exist only on the same app. So it's like there's one tree that is like a directory lookup, and there's some attributes on the side that only same are involved about. So
there's some limit.
And I don't understand how this can be, but that's how it's implemented. Like,
well,
it's hidden from the...
Nothing's hidden. I mean, it's not the door of every protocol to provide the same exact access to the same exact data. Each protocol has its own documented ADM, and as we document in ASO, there is overlap of these ADMs so that there is shared data which can be accessed by more than one protocol. That does not mean that there is some data which can... There is also some data which can only be accessed by certain protocols. So, I mean, yeah. You have to... So as a client, the client normally hits the protocol that provides access to the data which it needs. So, I mean, nothing you're describing is unusual.
If I'm managing the registry as a tree, right? Let's say it's doing a tree, and I'm just enumerating the trees, and the nodes over there, so it's like, this node does not exist on the tree, or it just... It basically, what you're saying, you choose not to reveal it on this protocol. So it requires, like, more effort.
I don't really understand the registry analogy, which is a...
It's like,
has a single
just like my abstraction of imagining how it builds, like the database builds like a tree, that you have nodes that sits below nodes, and the LDAP is just a way to enumerate this and travel that.
No, I mean, the best way to think of it is, I mean, they are distinct protocols with distinct ADMs with a sharing of state among the ADMs. I mean, so there's, as I said, there's no, I mean, in general, I mean, it's the design of the system.
The protocol, basically.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
So no protocol provides complete access to the pool.
Yeah, it's a lot of information. It's really hard.
So I want to get back to his question, if I can get to yours. There should. Are you sure it was Sam R and not necessarily like LSAT?
LSA.
It was it? Were you doing a SID name translation across the trust?
That sounds more like it because that's unauthenticated, right?
Yeah, that one. If we may want to follow up with the protocol doc process for testing, and we can get feedback. That very specific one is interesting because SID name translation is not expressed via a security via an access write on an object like LDAP and SAMR, but rather it's a write for the entire domain controller. We want to do some forensic investigation to see what's breaking along the way. I don't know the answer off the top of the head on that one, although it sounds really familiar.
What worked was, in this case, if we asked A to translate the SID, then A would under the covers ask B, and everybody was happy. If we tried to ask B directly, using the obvious following the trusts and talking LDAP process,
how are you resolving the SID with LDAP, just doing a query against the object SID attribute?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you want to, that's, so doing, trying to do an LDAP query, you're going to be going, you're going to be subject to the governance of the directory.
It makes perfect sense to me. You seem to be talking about LDAP is better than the others, more general.
Well, I think this isn't about better or worse. This is about history and backward compatibility. LSAT has been around for years, not in this named form, but the capabilities have been there for donkey's years in an unauthenticated manner.
There are things you can only do with LSAT, you can't do.
Yes, I mean, when you're coming out with LDAP as more general, we're not saying LDAP is a strict superset, it's a larger set.
Okay.
But then, if you think of it as a Venn diagram, there are areas, it's not a set of perfect concentric circles. There are areas which, some protocols will cover which others do not. The area covered by LDAP is probably beta, but that doesn't mean it is a pure superset of all the other protocols.
So
maybe
we can have a different question. Like, are you going to have an effort to have everything on LDAP over time, for example?
Well, this is my point. I was about to get to this. Yeah. It is there. It's just that you don't have the trust relationship in place to permit the authentication to occur transparently.
Yeah, but
whereas because of the legacy behaviors inherent in LSAT, we do honor that request.
There are other examples that just doesn't exist on LDAP. This example another way.
I don't think there are examples where it just doesn't exist via LDAP, unless, Nathan, maybe you can tack onto that. Do you know?
No, the protocol document, all I can say is the protocol documentation is the ultimate reference for this type. We feel your pain when it comes to multiple protocols and different types of nuances in behavior, and we'll move. And I can't make any statement about future protocol development or efforts because we don't know where things are gonna head. But we do understand that there's multiple protocols into the directory, and you have to read the protocol documentation to understand if there's specific behavior that you're looking for. And if there's differences between them, to choose which one you want to use.
And if you would like them to be the same, we have a policy that allows you to cut that ability off, so then at least SAMR and LSAT would behave the same as LDAP and deny you access, and then you get a consistent response.
Trust me, protocol documentation would be a lot easier for everybody, including us, too, if we all went over one protocol, but that's just not the world that we're in, and I can't speculate about where things are going
to
go.
There's no plans in that respect, at least, at the moment.
Say again?
There's no plan saying... He doesn't know what to say, what the road for the future.
No, I don't think any of us would be prepared to make that kind of wild bet.
The attributes he referred to us yesterday is our first incoming and first outgoing.
Those are available over LDAP. They're in the schema. They are accessible through LDAP.
Well, depends what we mean by accessible. If he's saying that, can you read the clear text password, or can you actually see the attributes via LDAP? It's a little bit different.
The basically question here is some of the trusted domain objects attributes can't be read by the LDAP. Those attributes only read by the LSAD protocols.
And they're
It's there in documentation. It edits documents and the LSAD document, trusted domain objects. The attributes like trusted, trust auth incoming, trust auth outgoing. There are the attributes which can't be read by the LDAP.
Well, as it proves in here, we're not walking oracles that have verbal interactions or representations of the protocol docs.
I'm tired when I read the document at 10 at night. Now I have my product need to be shipped in just 2 days or last time. I got another month in development because I need to implement another protocol so it would be nice if Microsoft considered to have everything on LDAP,
Well, now Nathan will make a note to at least have a chat between the product groups here and figure out why that is and see what we can do.
You're not going to make any commitment or there's no plan at the moment, but
absolutely.
From perspective, it would be nice if you can build just one protocol and figure out everything from there.
So I'll tell you what, if as a community of folks that are implementing the Active Directory suite of protocols, when we looked at application development and we encouraged folks to develop on modern protocols, and we could possibly achieve that someday somehow, but who's to say? Protocols are developing very fastly on the internet, that type of stuff.
Trust me, the message will be nice.
Yes.
Thank you. So where the protocols interact with each other, where would you go to find the information? If there's some sort of cross protocol, there's a layer that applies some type of policy across protocols.
Do you mean the coherency between the two? I'm not sure I understand the question, do you?
So so on the server side, I think what you're asking is, where do I go from the protocol documentation to find, from a data model, an abstract data model perspective, where the data models may overlap or not overlap between the various views into the directory? So we have this covered in ADSO, and we'll get back to Dean's presentation. But an implementer of a domain controller need not have to have it one database. They could certainly have a table, say, for example, per protocol, and then following ADSO synchronization between the tables, you can achieve something similar. So it's not necessarily that an implementer's got to follow the exact same way, that everything's got to be in one table and have those views. But the individual technical documents like SAMR talk about the ADM and the security model around that, and then ADSO talks about things like the shared state, where is this attribute is authored maybe in one protocol and could be read via LDAP, that type of stuff.
And we'll give you an example on the slides in just a second. That's one of the areas that we felt was significant enough to make it into the presentation. So, yeah, very thoroughly covered in the doc itself, though. Okay, all good questions. Okay, in fear of getting any more, I shall move on from that slide. So what about the ADM then, the abstract data model? ADM is becoming a word, I imagine, to most of you. So I think this is about as specific to your question as is coincidentally possible. This is the very slide that I was talking about, and we then jump into some examples. So basically we're talking about here the notion of shared state among the protocols that allow you to communicate with the directory service. And we've crafted a particular example here. So if SAMR performs an atomic update against state shared with LDAP, then LDAP must provide a view of either all or none of SAMR's changes. So for example, if SAMR were to update two attributes, but from the client side you perceive that as one operation, and then LDAP tries to read any one of those attributes, it cannot read one halfway through the transaction. Both must represent the same value once LDAP gets the response back. Okay, so I think that's speaking directly to the question that you just asked, so good piece of coincidental timing there. So obviously ADSO details the mapping of the shared state amongst these protocols. It's an area where we focused a great deal of attention, and there are coherency requirements listed there, whether it's a one-way or a two-way relationship, so you should find that ADSO is more than adequate to give you what you need there. One final comment here. We deem that the data model that AD's system has as a whole is not its own. We deem it to be the union of all of the protocols that comprise AD. So I think that statement is fairly self-explanatory. So if you take a look at the ADM for all of the member protocols, then that represents the ADM of the Active Directory system as a whole. And there's but one example. This is pretty much how it's listed. We morphed it slightly to make it fit into a slide a little better. But in this particular example, we're basically saying that MS-LSAD shares some state with MS-SAMR, and we're showing you specifically which attributes share that state, or which elements share that state, I should say. Okay, I left this slide in there because, mainly because it took Nathan weeks to put it together. So out of respect for Nathan, I would like to give him a round of applause just for the amount of effort required in doing that. You have no idea. I see no reason why you shouldn't. It was banded with MS Confidential all across the bottom, but I've no idea why, so we erased that. It would be somewhat silly. So obviously here you can just see the parallel between the colorization that Nathan's trying to represent. This is SAMR's view of the directory and how LDAP represents the very same subset. Nathan, is this exhaustive? It better be with that amount of information.
Is it exhaustive?
You're not sure, eh, anymore? Okay, so it's as exhaustive as Nathan could be bothered to do, which is probably yes, but remains to be seen on current versions.
I actually did this content for my own purposes. I was kind of interested how these things overlap between each other. I don't know if I would use this as normative or anything else, but certainly it's a way to represent that you have different ADMs on top of each other. And even on LDAP, you've got a user, but the user object class inherits from other object classes, which is kind of the LDAP model, and not every object... the user object class doesn't have all the definitive list of attributes, so there is kind of some you know, merging together that these have to take place.
I think that's a great point worth mentioning again, so it makes it clearly and bluntly onto the recording. This is by no means normative content. This is Nathan's best effort at providing something that's useful as a table of contents and how you map them overall.
Anybody can build this going through SAMR and doing a lot of cut and pasting and then going through the schema documents that we've provided and taken a look at the attributes if they felt really interested in doing that.
The only scary part I find about that is the fact that Nathan actually enjoyed doing it. Other than that, the data itself is what it is. So thank you, Nathan. We appreciate your effort. So section 5, summary of ADSO then. What is the implementer's choice? Well, I think Nathan was talking about some aspects of this earlier, but let's just take a look at these sub-bullets here then. So as long as you meet the rules for coherency and the ADM mappings are followed, then there are several different hypothetical implementations that one could choose to use. So Nathan mentioned one earlier where rather than having two protocol heads that just serve as a mapping onto the same database and expose what they expose, one presumably being a subset of the other, you could actually implement that as two entirely discrete tables within the same data store, two entirely separate files, however your particular implementation chooses to work. But it would then be your responsibility to maintain the synchronization between those two tables in whatever level of atomicity you choose is appropriate. We would obviously mention that we think that's a requirement. or you can either do both updates at the same time. So you can either sync or just update both in tandem. How you do it is entirely up to you. So you can either do it with views or with separate tables, and that's what we're attempting to illustrate. One protocol or one table per protocol view. So you can see here that we've got Samar, Dean, Matt, and Nate, and then over here we've got it over LDAP. So basically we're saying that in this particular instance we've maintained two entirely discrete tables. We're not just mapping the protocol heads into the same data store. Whereas here, we're doing the polar opposite. Are these making sense? This is entirely the implementer's choice how you do this. Obviously, I have a preference. I imagine you probably have a preference as well. That idea of duplicating anything is always somewhat less satisfying than providing a single instance of the data, but it's entirely up to you how you do it. All right, so that's all I wanted to discuss on ADSO. It's difficult to put together overview content on an overview document because you're not quite sure what's not as relevant as something else. Hopefully, we managed to pick on some sections in there that you found valuable. So let me jump swiftly into DSO. This is quite a detailed document and contains a different way of representing the information. It's all built upon use cases. So you can just go through and see use case after use case after use case from which hopefully you'll find a very, very useful medium to understand the way that the system behaves very, very quickly. So here's a little snippet of sections, again, 2 through 4. And now let's give you a quick idea of DSO's view of the core components in its little universe. Well, there are only two, the domain controller and the domain client. And I think these terms are fairly self-explanatory, but I'll reference them anyway. So obviously a domain controller, or colloquially referred to as a DC, an instance of the server in a domain that hosts the full account database. Obviously, you can use any level of terminology you like there and get a bit more Microsoft specific, but that's a good generalism. And it aggregates functionality for identity management, authentication, blah, 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 blah. So that's the typical definition of a domain controller. A domain client, about the only interesting thing in here is the suffix at the end of the first sub-bullet point. So a domain client is any member of the domain, but we do not include domain controllers. Even though they obviously have affiliation with the domain, we don't label them under the banner of a domain client. The behaviors are too different. Clients of a domain controller obviously rely on it for establishing secure connections, etc. Nothing radical in that particular slide, but worth pointing out. So obviously we need to discuss some of the notions that AD creates specifically, this notion of domains, trees, forests, and trusts. So prior to Active Directory's terminology influx, we had this notion of X500, we had this notion of tree, and we had this notion of hierarchy within directory services models. Then obviously when we added multiple trees to that, by virtue of, if this was a single forest, and we've got a collection of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 domains, we've added this new concept now because we now have a tree of domains. It's not a tree of OUs or hierarchy with inside that domain. It's a tree of domains themselves where the hierarchy is created by the contiguity of the domain names and the trust relationships between them. So if this domain is called example.com, this is a child of example.com by virtue of its DNS adhering name, whereby we add a name or a prefix to the left, a new label at the front of the DNS name, and a trust relationship is automatically created between these two, expressed as a TDO with inside each domain. When you get a collection of domains with inside a single rooted hierarchy like this, we call it a domain tree. So in this forest, we have 2 domain trees, 1 forest, and 5 domains. And obviously, this is where Microsoft introduced the brand new term some years back, forest. Prior to us, there was no such collective unit. So I wanted to mention that real quickly. Does anyone have any specific questions around trusts, terminology there, or how this stuff functions, glues together? No? Good. Okay. So here's the domain interaction system, then, the distributed model. Obviously, there are a number of components involved in any Active Directory implementation. There are core infrastructure services that have to be present. Name resolution is one of them. I'm sure most of you that have built anything to do with Active Directory are well aware that if DNS breaks, something else tends to go with it. So name resolution is a very, very core component, and I would thoroughly recommend that regardless of whether it's necessary for your implementation, you at least understand how it works so you know how to guard against failures with it. Obviously, here we have domain clients as workstations. They interoperate. Here we've got authentication, and we're calling out the particular technical document that covers authentication from a systems overview standpoint. So we have domain client servers that communicate with domain controllers, specifically the KDC or the DC's NTLM capabilities, and domain clients doing the same. And then obviously we have peer relationship capabilities as well, for example, where I might map a drive to a file server that's a domain member in the same domain as me or crosses a domain boundary over a trust. So just trying to represent exactly what the level of distribution is there. Here are the system protocols that are used for domain interactions. This is, as best as I can tell off the top of my head, an exhaustive list. I believe I attempted to make that exhaustive. I won't go down each of these because it's rather lengthy, but in the square brackets at the end, we have each of the docs that correlate to that particular member protocol so that you can go and find the detailed documentation about it in order to make your implementation as fully functional as is possible. Any questions on the protocols that are listed there? No? Protocols that leverage netlog and RPC interfaces would encompass some of those, but sure, yeah, I mean, perhaps some of them are well-known enough to have been called out. Yeah, fair point.
Oh, there you go. So it's under MSAPDS.
Yeah, that's the one I was just mentioning. Yeah.
MSAPDS covers...
Yeah, so as I just said, the protocols that leverage netlog and...
So the question is, where is NTLM? NTLM doesn't actually have a domain interaction, but MSAPDS covers NTLM pass-through, PAC validation, which is what curb, you'll see it for server to DC for curb, as say NTLM curb, as well as, I think it's, I'll let you speak on
RCMP. Well, RCMP is on there too, but basically it all goes over netlog on to do the pass-through stuff. So, I mean, I think it's covered by that.
Yes, it does follow the trust in the forest, and there are basically no restrictions. If one DC in one forest trusts another DC in another forest, they do have a netlogon secure channel in between them, and if you do pass-through authentication, it will go through secure channel, find the name, and bring back you the secret.
It's a great answer. For the sake of the recording, could you at least illustrate what the question was, because even I didn't hear it.
he asked if pass-through authentication works on forest trust between two forests. Point LM, yes, it does. Well, yeah, it goes through netlogon, but it does. Basically, for NTLM, it's transparent. NTLM doesn't know we are going, we are netlogon to a different forest. Netlogon is the one that manages the blob to bring it to
so
a domain controller.
So it needs to know where to go, right?
So yes.
It goes to the closed active directory netlogon, and then it will propagate between
yes.
Kerberos.
Okay, so the thing is, right, NTLM just does pass through netlogon. At that point, it's netlogon, right? Netlogon finds the route, right? Kerberos has its own concept. It understands trust, right? So for Kerberos, you talk to a KDC. KDCs understand trust. KDC sends you to the next guy in the trust, right?
I mean, like netlogon, the pass through, doesn't have transactivity as Kerberos. So you have...
No. So Kerberos uses Kerberos, right? The only thing that uses netlogon pass-through, right, generic pass-through for curb, is PAC validation.
So you need to find your...
But that's only for PAC validation. And it's from the server, and it provides it to its domain controller, right?
So if the domain controller doesn't have this object, it's not a domain controller.
Right. That's why you get PAC failures sometimes, right? If it can't validate... Right, and then...
So the server needs to know how to find the right domain controller?
No, the server sends it to netlogon, which sends it to the main controller. So from Kerr's standpoint, we give it to netlogon, right, and it goes, right? As soon as you use generic pass-through for netlogon, you basically provide an opaque blob to netlogon. Netlogon takes care of it. It's the postman, right? You stick the package in the slot, and it disappears, and then you get a response back. And you have no idea where it went or how it went there or whatever, but you either get, you know, whatever response.
I was thinking, probably netlogon propagates through the domain controller.
No. There's no Kerberos to netlogon integration whatsoever. That's the only piece there, and we just call it as an API.
Okay.
One thing to add to that is, so DSO... talks about domain client ADM. some of the elements in there are used by NetLogon, for example, to initiate the first secure channel setup between it and the domain controller, and that's how it finds. And then once it's got the secure channel set up, then all this magic happens. But that's an example of how a domain join client, its ADM is used by, say, AuthZo to or NetLogon to then find a domain controller to start this whole process.
Any more? Yep, go ahead, sir. Sorry. Where is curb delegation covered?
S4U.
The doc is called S4U? MS-S4U covers curb delegation. I wouldn't consider that to be a domain interaction. It's going so heavily into the curb aspect. I mean, it is a domain interaction, I suppose, in the generic sense, but I don't believe it's encompassed by DSO. So how about this? How about I retract the statement that is not an exhaustive list? That way, I'm done. I thought it was, and I got most of it by covering this one. But S4U, no, I'm stretching it to get that in there.
Well, if you say Kerberos, you say MS Pile. MS Pile refers to other things.
So I use that as a piggyback into all the others that it refers to. Yes, I've got it all covered then. I should have just listed the generic table of contents in the entire protocol family, and then I'd have been good. All right, so moving quickly on then. The purpose of a domain system, well, I think we all know what the purpose of a domain system is, because in the absence of one, managing lots and lots of Windows machines is somewhat of a nightmare, obviously, because you have so many discrete little account stores. So obviously a common set of identifiers, again, to use abstract terms, mechanisms for authenticating these actors within the system to one another based upon those identifiers, mechanisms for associating that authorization information, again, with those identifiers to allow for more efficient authorization provisioning, and last but not least, mechanism for managing these systems and their associated operating environments used by the actors within the system. I really hate reading bullet points, but again, I wrote these, so it's a bit difficult to come up with anything better. So the bottom one is specifically referring to the technologies that serve as the basis for systems that leverage these components, group policy and DFS being but two. We don't consider them as Active Directory features. Most people do. Group policy is not what we consider something that we own. It's something that leverages the way the directory expresses hierarchy. And then policies enforced using its own mechanisms. So to leverage domain capabilities, a client has to become domain joined for the most part, right? I think we've already had a partial discussion on that. But if you truly want to leverage our idea of domain capabilities, you do need to be domain joined. There are three possible ways here. This is that I've listed. This is not, again, exhaustive. Not exhaustive. Let's just be clear. So we can join the domain using a predefined account, basically the notion of an account already exists for you, and you're simply gluing your state to that state. Join and create the account via SAMRPC or do the same via LDAP. So let's have a very specific look at each of those. And this one, I promise you, I'm not going to read top down. It would just take too long. So I'll ask you to have a brief look at the particular flow of this predefined account domain join operation. And if you have any questions, by all means, feel free to answer. But this is obviously nothing more than a copy and paste from the DSO document itself. There are many, many of these listed in there which provide a very, very good overall guide to the way that particular process works, and then obviously a great deal of text to back up precisely what's going on in the diagram. Nothing jumps out at you there? Okay, so that's joining using a predefined account, creating the account via SAMRPC. We've simplified this one down very slightly, so here we're talking about the Kerberos authentication service request, the reply, the ticket granting service request, and the reply, SMB session setup. For a number of different things, it could be leveraging something like, it could be accessing SysVault to apply policy. There's a number of different things that go on across these protocols. And then last but not least, doing precisely the same thing via LDAP looks very similar until we get down to the bottom, and then the specifics of that protocol's implementation come into play. Yes, go ahead. SAMR cannot control that. No, it's a configuration setting, so that state's preserved on the server side. So when you create an object via SAMR, it will be dropped into a container. It's possible for you to configure where that container resides. By default, it will dump into the users if it's a user in a computer's container, but that can obviously be reconfigured. Something you want to tack on there? Nathan wants to speak.
It would be nice if we had that.
We get asked for that a lot. So the question is, when I create a computer account, say through SAMR, can I specify OU? No, because of course SAM doesn't have any concept of XF500 because it was created well before that. There's some resource kit tools that we have. I don't know how they get delivered these days, if they're on box or online.
They're on box.
That allows you to change the default place that computer accounts go. Our general advice to customers is that it's a post-provisioning activity, as in they have to move it to the OU via some type of provisioning, but now we're kind of getting a little bit outside of the protocol documentation.
Those tools are reader, user, and reader comp, where user is abbreviated to USR and comp to CMP, if it's of any relevance.
And that might be a reason to choose, you know, SAM or LDAP for computer account creation.
So what you're basically asking for is a brand new protocol called SAMDAP.
One of our eternal debates is what things we should do via LDAP and what things we should do via other protocols. And it seems like if we want to solve this problem by letting customers specify a container, we have to use LDAP.
To do it via SAM would be just an obnoxious implementation, because you'd literally be telling the directory server just prior to creating the account via SAM, redirect to that container, create the account, now put it back to the default. That's a horrible thing to manage, especially if somebody else was creating an account at the same time.
But up until Windows 7, we were creating accounts with SAMR.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because we can't let go. Okay. All right, so that's the end of the overview of the overviews, which I confess did take a little bit of effort to try and figure out what you'd find relevant. So with any luck, I did actually hit on some things that you found interesting. We at least got some questions, so I'll take that as representative of yes. Plus, it makes my ego feel better. So here's a little bit of a summary of what ADSO does for you then. So ADSO encompasses the collective set of protocols that basically enable you to access and manipulate directory data. So again, to use Matt's term, it's the directoryness, the X500-like behaviors of it. We obviously treat the directory as a single service comprised of multiple nodes where each directory server is capable of answering with the same precise data based upon the fact that we've got obviously replication capabilities in there. Moving down to DSO, this is basically how components are invoked by domain clients. We obviously cover a slew of domain interaction tasks here, as I've shown you in the earlier use cases, and it discusses how the protocols are used together to maintain a relationship with the domain. And then there's a number of those listed here, again, not an exhaustive list. So obviously, as we've said earlier, we'll make this slide deck specifically for that mapping between SAMR and LDAP available to you guys. I will again point out that although Nathan did his due diligence there, by no means is he attesting to the absolute exhaustive list that that is not. So he's not stating that that thing is end-to-end. It's as close as he could get at the time. So with that, we'll move directly on to Q&A and see if we can get any more questions out of you. Go ahead. Did you say report it?
The group policies, if you want to import that.
Oh, import them.
From directory to a device, how do you basically query the directory for all the policies and what is the recommended protocol?
I don't think we'd have a recommended protocol for that, and it falls well outside the purview of what we're doing here in terms of our suite of protocol family documents. I can certainly answer the question for you, but it's not something that's going to be a normative answer. I don't know what their docs look like or to what extent they cover this. So there's one called GPSO, sounds like a fair name, Group Policy System Overview, that will probably answer some of that. In terms of querying all the policies that are linked in the directory, you would simply do start an LDAP query at the top and query for GP link equals star. That will give you every single group policy linkage throughout that particular scope of the LDAP query, so depending on where you originate the query, the base, and then the scope thereafter. Yes. There's a massive white card at the back going like this that says repeat the question. So I think I shall. So the question was, how do I find out where group policies are linked within a particular domain? So again, the answer was do an LDAP query that looks for GP link equals populated. That's what the asterisk indicates. Good question. And thank you for the prompt, sir. Very inventive. Do you have one with shut up on it when I go over? Any other questions? Do we have a ration on the number of questions any individual's allowed to ask? I was just wondering. I'm totally teasing you. You ask away, sir.
Okay. So with regard to like service keys and Kerberos and
So what attribute are you looking for? The password?
Like the service keys, for example, for Kerberos, I want the keys or something. So I'm a server. I add myself. You do something to be a Kerberos server at the domain, like some people don't need to pay, for example. Like a KRB join that you have to do or something.
No, I'm not familiar with the confused looks from both of us, or we have no idea what that is. So, I mean, the key, again, so like if you look at MIT, right, they have their own data store. Our data store is Active Directory, which I realize is, you know, a much bigger data store than we need just to implement Kerberos. But that's where Windows puts all their account information. So we just make a call to them to get the key, right? That they're our data store. That's abstracted. We just say, hey, I need the long-term key. They give us a long-term key. We use that, right? We use SAM, I believe, for that, as I recall.
For what?
Password retrieval. Or maybe we use LSA. It's an internal call, so yeah. It's abstracted to us because it's an API. But what would you use externally or for publicly for that, for password calls?
You don't.
So Active Directory, and including ADLDS, like every other implementer of an LDAP server out there, doesn't store the passwords in reversible encryption. So you can't go, and it's not an attribute that you can read and actually get that data. You have to go through one of the auth protocols.
So as long as they know what the clear text password is. Do you know the clear text version of the password at any point?
Yeah, well, let's say I want to be an Exchange server in the domain. So I implement Exchange and I want to operate with Exchange for Microsoft. And those servers, you know, they can have like shared mailboxes. So all the security is going to be shared, right? So how can I, as a server, let's say that also the Exchange doesn't have to see where the domain controller is. Like, it's very distributed. So there is some way for the Exchange to go and ask over the network in a secure way, what's the long-term key for...
Two Exchange servers actually don't share, they're different machine accounts. If you were writing your own domain controller using the protocol documentation, certainly what you're talking about could be an implementation detail. From the guise of the protocol documentation, if you're a domain client, we don't provide any means through the protocol documentation, I think, of having... of doing the password piece.
So first, let me clear up a misconception, right? Exchange, when they do this, they don't retrieve any password from, again, like I said, you don't retrieve any password information from a domain controller. The KDC, which resides on the AD, right, we have interfaces back and forth because they're our store. That never goes out on the wire. You can't ask Curb for a password, you can't ask AD for the password, right? What happens is Exchange has the password configured when it's provisioned. And you know the password, and you create an authenticator. The authenticator comes to us, which the KDC that's on the AD. Then I basically ask for my key material from them. I basically validate the authenticator, and if it's good, I say they're good, and if it's not, I give you an error, right?
The domain controller or the KDC, right, is from what I understood from a Microsoft implementation perspective, how to provide the Exchange service key to the client?
No, we don't do any. Again, there is no transaction from a domain controller to a client on passwords, right? The DC, the KDC, the NetLogon server, NTLM servers, none of them will ever, ever write a password back, right? If you look at how Kerberos works, inside of a message, there will be a session key that is produced.
TGS reply ticket,
yes,
has the service key in
it? No, it does not. It has a session key. It has a brand new key that it made up. That's a session key, which it puts in the message with the ticket, and it gives it to the client.
Are you labeling it a service key? Because Microsoft's documentation often mixes up those terms, whether in actual fact synonyms, service key and session key.
When the
to us, at least,
sends the AP request,
right,
it sends the AP request the server ticket, right?
So if you look at Kerberos, this is documented, by the way, in TechNet's Kerberos guide, right? No, I'm just saying, if you want more details, you can pull up the Kerberos technical reference. and it walks through all the messages. But from a high-level standpoint, right, during the AP request, there's a session key. This session key is not stored in Active Directory anywhere, right? So there's a session key that is encrypted in a key that can be long-term key that's used by the server, right? That can is in there. But that actual session key that's being transmitted in the messages are not part of the objects.
So the server, when it gets the AP request, it needs to get the session key also, right? So
and it decrypts the session key with its long-term key.
It decrypts not the session key, it decrypts the ticket.
No, it decrypts the session key as well, right? Because keep in mind, in Kerberos, when you look at Kerberos, and again, like that's why I refer to the tech graph, every time you transmit a ticket, you transmit the corresponding key with the ticket, right? The session key that goes with that ticket. Both of those things are decrypted by those entities in order to be used. Never, ever, you can't. I mean, if you look at the RFC, you can't just transmit a ticket, right? You have to always transmit a session key. So in an AP request, what you're going to get is a service ticket and a session key that both the client knows and now you know because you decrypted it in the ticket, with the ticket.
How does the server decrypt it?
Because it does it with its long-term key.
The server's long-term key is the computer
and that long-term
password.
Key is the one it, so it does through password changes.
Who encrypted the ticket?
The KDC.
Domain controller.
The KDC, so he has that, he has some...
It has the long-term Kerberos key, which you will always update as a service using password
so
change mechanisms.
How do I update it as a service?
Kerberos password change. Kerberos password change protocol.
Okay,
right?
So that's the question.
Right? So as I said, all passwords for accounts are updated by the corresponding protocols using their password change mechanism. Kerberos has a standard, and you need to use the standard to update your password. Session keys are not kept anywhere. His database does not know any of that information, right?
So is that protocol to support reading the password or just changing the password?
Just changing the password. It's a standard. Just look it up in IETF if you just type. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because that's the reason that we went to that is because we interoperate with MIT. So someone was pointing out that MIT has an implementation as well. And so does Heimdall, for that matter, right? That doesn't work if the other end isn't curved, right? So the reason Windows supports it is that way you can, if a Windows client changes password using that, on the other end, whether it's us or it's MIT or it's Heimdall, it'll get updated.
So going back, like you're saying, they change typically the user account.
And if it's the user account, they're responsible for password management. Yes. However they want to do that through scripting or whatever, but they're going to have to sync the passwords to everybody that's using that user account and change the password in the AD using a change password. You'd have to talk to Exchange. I don't know what their common deployment scenarios are. I know part of the reason we go to the managed service accounts, which David here is an expert on, is because it gives you the ability to not use a computer account but then have that management. But that only works for each instance on a computer. In other words, if I'm on server A, I have an Exchange instance on server A and an Exchange instance on server B, they're going to have different managed service accounts. They can't share one.
So if I want to be able to read or write, I have to be in that like that account. I have to have permissions in that account.
No, that's typically abstracted through grouping, the same way as Exchange does it.
You have to have a group, then you have the machine or the account that I'm logging to this information. I have to have permission in that group.
Yeah, so the service account is made a member of the group, and the group is the resource, the principal that's permissioned against the resources.
So in a domain that has a forest, an organization, and multiple servers, typically have one managed service for each instance of the server.
Yes.
What was the question?
So the question was if managed service, if we have multiple servers, each server should have its own managed service account. Yes, basically the implementation of MSAs, managed service accounts, started because of pain administrators went through when changing user passwords and synchronizing user passwords, since the main accounts were used as a service accounts. Managed service accounts managing their own passwords. But the limitation is there could be only one MSA per machine. So managed service accounts is linked to the machine. So if you have 10 servers, you will have 10 service account. I mean, one service account per machine, which means 10 service accounts. And
yeah, the operating system does it for you, so it's per machine.
Yes, it's per machine.
Can we just qualify the context there? The specific context was for Exchange, and to the best of my knowledge, Exchange does not use MSAs?
Well, there are limitations.
Possibly out of date, but...
There are limitations with Exchange, so the latest Exchange might be able to use them. But again, you have to have, it's Win7 and Server 2008 R2 only, so you have to... well, it depends on the deployment plan. So some people choose to use computer accounts, which are not that configurable, but they're changing their passwords by themselves. And some organizations choose to use user domain accounts, which usually is a preferred. That's the common deployment. But again, when you're using domain accounts or user accounts, you have to change all the passwords manually. Or scripted, which is also. Yes.
So it doesn't matter what account type you use, right? So I want to clarify that, because you said if you use a user account, you have to manage it. If you use a computer account, something has to change it, right? If you use a computer account for which there's a Windows computer, right, then Windows operating system will manage it. If you create a computer account with no system associated, you have to manage it. So I just want to make sure there's a clarity. It's not anything cool about the object. It's about the fact that we, as an operating system, will update that.
So you can create a virtual computer account.
Yeah, you could, and people do that, right? People sometimes pick a computer object because the user object has so much junk in it that they don't care about. They say, I'm going to create a computer object, and as long as the object's there, it works. But yeah, exactly. But there's no, like I said, there's no password management that comes with it. Okay, so the question, I'm going to give it to Nathan, but the question is, does Microsoft, when it does a domain join, is it using the Kerberos change password to set the password?
Depends on the version.
Was that the question, by the way?
It was.
I'm going to give that back to the
it's an executable. I mean, it can use any of them. I mean, it's subject to change. I mean, it's just an implementation detail.
We do it over Windows does it over I think SAM change password or over that let
log on. 3.7. 7 does it over K password.
The periodic, yes. The periodic change, or just the...
As far as I know.
All right. So the red answer to the original question, pre-Windows 7, domain join uses SAM, R, and then starting with Win7, they use Kerberos change password. Okay. So to answer Natalie's question, why don't we take this offline, since you have a very specific repro, if that makes any sense, and we'll probably need to get some more information from you. Principal unknown, there's lots of possible points of failure. So let me sync you up with Yi and Jeremy, and let's get down to exactly why in that case. Because like you said, in most cases it works fine. You just have a particular scenario where it's not working.
Any other questions?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, a document that covers all other documents and just provides a description of what they are?
No.
He's
really
talking about accounts.
Managed service accounts. No,
oh, I misheard.
Managed service accounts really are not a protocol. I mean, they're just an ordinary account. They support the ordinary head rules. Yeah, they're an implementation feature.
Right, but I mean, the question, he said object. So is there something that covers the object?
It's a user object, like any other account.
Right, it's derived from a user object.
There is in the Active Directory schema documents, there is a managed service account, which I think we like subclass the computer account or something like that.
Okay.
So
the hierarchy goes user, computer, MSA.
Send that picture.
Nathan did that pre-R2, so he wouldn't have actually encompassed any additionals.
Well, that was just a user.
Yeah. I think the computers are subclassed off of user. And then, the managed service accounts, I think, are subclassed off of the computer account or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, so managed service accounts, a bit of a misnomer about managed service accounts is you could create an object in AD to represent a managed service account prior to us doing it. The magic is really just that the system, the domain client, periodically refreshes it, the same policy interval as the machine account policy, but there's nothing to say that you have to follow that policy. There's nothing on the domain controller side that enforces it. Windows workstations follow good hygiene, and we set the random password to some very long
max entropy. Number 196 white bytes or something like that. It's ridiculously long.
If we had to do it over again, we probably would have enforced password policy on machine accounts. So if you're implementing a domain join client, please follow good hygiene and refresh it periodically. There is a policy in the domain that you can optionally follow. The intent is set by an administrator for all machines to follow, which is how often they should change their password. If it were me doing an implementation, I would probably follow that policy for any of my service accounts that run beyond just the machine account. But that's not a protocol documentation thing. It's a recommendation.
So we all clear on the conclusion there. MSAs are not the function of the directory service. They are just a function of the operating system and requires Win7 or R2 to actually make them do anything useful. Otherwise, they just sit there static, doing nothing.
You don't have to. Yeah, you don't have to use that object to do a service account. You could use a user object or a computer object if you so desired.
Any other questions? I'm scared to ask. Any more? Oh, go on. We've been doing so well. No? All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. We enjoyed that. Thanks for the interaction.